You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Are you ready for climate shock? Your home probably won't burn down, so why bother buying fire insurance? Because it might. And that's part of a powerful new argument for climate action coming not from scientists, but from economists. Gernot Wagner is a lead senior economist at the Environmental Defense Fund. He also teaches at Columbia University. He advocates for market-based solutions for environmental problems. He's teamed up with Martin Weitzman, a Harvard professor of economics, to write a new book, Climate Shock: The Economic Consequences of a Hotter Planet. Gernot, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I think your book is unique by saying we could do more about climate change precisely because the science is still uncertain. How does that work?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. What we know is clearly enough to propel us to act. What we don't know, though, is where this stuff really hits home. At the end of the day, it is a risk management problem that we ought to be focused on here. And yes, it's the risk, it's the uncertainty that really ought to drive action now.
Scientists occasionally talk about fat tail risk. Now, what is that, and what's it got to do with climate change?
Fat tails is actually, turns out, the scientific statistical term being used here. And what that really means is that there are low probability, high consequence events that will most likely, right, we don't know for sure, but likely define the final outcome. Right? Some might call it black swans. Other call it, you know, life happens. Statisticians call it fat tail. And that, when you look at climate change and the implications of the science, is what makes it so costly.
Yes, I see. Nassim Taleb has endorsed your book. What is the relationship between the idea of a black swan that he made famous and your work?
Well, in some sense, climate shock is a black swan for the climate, right? Nassim Nicholas Taleb focused on financial markets, while we use the exact same logic and look at climate change. In other words, it is those low probability. They are low probability, right? We can say that it is likely that these extreme events are going to happen, but they are such high impact that even a relatively low probability has enormous consequences.
Well, I know that official estimates for the amount of warming we will see this century alone go from a couple of degrees all the way beyond 6 degrees C or 11 degrees Fahrenheit. Those are shocking possibilities, and I guess you're saying we should plan for that possibility.
Exactly, right? So on average, well, let me put it this way. On average, things are going to be very, very bad. And the feature of talking about averages is, well, 50% of the time you're too high, 50% you're too low. But what we are really focused on is not the average number at all. We are looking at, so what's the chance of a true planetary catastrophe? And the way we define it in the book is, right, everyone talks about 2 degrees centigrade as a threshold not to be crossed. We look at 6 degrees. There is no mistaking 6 degrees as nothing other than a planetary catastrophe, right? You could have arguments what 2 degrees is, or maybe 3 degrees, 4 or 5, or 6 is so far out there for a global average warming eventually that no one would mistake this as anything other than a planetary scale catastrophe. Now, we look at that 6 degree centigrade, run the numbers, and come up with a chance of eventual global warming exceeding 6 degrees of at least around 10%, unless we act, right? There's always that attached, too. It is always unless we, in fact, take the kind of action that scientists, economists, environmentalists, everyone else for that matter, at this point is talking about that we ought to be taking to avoid global warming.
Well, we can say, well, 10%, that's not much of a chance, but if you and I were playing Russian roulette and we had a gun with 10 chambers in it and one has a live bullet, we'd take it much more seriously, I think.
That's exactly the point, right? So 10% isn't, in fact, likely, right? It is likely that we will not exceed the 6 degrees average global warming for the planet. And that's good news, of course, because 6 degrees is like you. I like the Russian roulette analogy, right? That's exactly it. A 10% chance of losing everything is pretty darn high.
It is indeed. Now, you know, often at the end of our interview, I end up asking, well, what can the individual do? But I'd like to bring that right up front, as you do in your book. In an article published in Salon Magazine last March, you suggested our individual action may be pointless. It doesn't really matter if we recycle or even if we vote. Gernot, what were you really talking about there?
Well, as usual, right, there's a twist there. It's not saying don't recycle, don't vote. It's saying recycle well, vote well. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, it turns out that as economists, right, we are sort of trained to believe that there are trade-offs. And I'd like to think it's not just the buyer's economists have. Life is full of trade-offs, right? You can't always get what you want, basically. Well, when you look at these trade-offs, right, and when you look at limited attention spans, limited time, limited money, we ought to choose how we spend our resources very, very wisely. If we misspend them on interventions, on actions that don't get us the biggest bang for the buck, well, we are wasting money, we are wasting time, we are wasting resources. So that's really what we mean by, right, recycling well, voting well. Or in other words, do those things, right? I do them too, right? I'm vegetarian, I don't have a driver's license, I do all these things. And we all should be doing them, of course, but frankly, only if they also lead to more. To the kinds of action, to the kinds of climate action that is truly necessary.
Yeah, I sense your frustration with people who think themselves pretty green because they've got a cloth bag or they use a bicycle, and then they don't look at what that last plane trip just did to the atmosphere.
That's the point, right? That's part of the point. And frankly, I'm in that boat, right? I bike everywhere. I don't use plastic bags as much as I can avoid them. And at the end of the day, well, then I refuse the plastic bag at the checkout counter and I walk my takeout onto a plane, right? So it's that on the individual level. But of course, really what we ought to be concerned about is that kind of misguided action, if you will, on the societal level, right? So when we do public policy and we focus on, okay, what is truly necessary here, it takes much, much more than recycling, right? Sort of newsflash, recycling isn't going to solve global warming. Okay, so what will, right? And what will, of course, is the large-scale changes to the way we do business that are necessary here. And what that takes, frankly, is pricing CO2.
All right. Now, you and Weitzman pinpoint four barriers that make climate change action, like you just suggested, a lot harder. Could you tell us about a couple of those barriers?
Climate change, in many ways, is the perfect problem. Right? It is global, by definition, global warming. It is long-term. It's, in many ways, more long-term than many other public policy problems out there. It is uniquely irreversible in many ways, at least in human timescales, and it is extremely, extremely uncertain. Right, so now you put the four together, uniquely global, uniquely long-term, uniquely irreversible, uniquely uncertain, and you have what you can only describe as the perfect problem. So what do you do with that? Well, first of all, right, that's what makes tackling climate change so difficult. It also means that really what's necessary here is systemic change, right? Systemic thinking. It's the overall system that ought to change here, not just sort of individual pieces on the margin. We have to fundamentally rethink the way we are doing business.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Gernot Wagner, co-author of the book Climate Shock. One thing I'm just still asking myself about your book, looking into a dystopic future where we don't do anything, or certainly not enough to curb emissions, you predict the rich of this world will survive and the poor will not. Why is that?
Well, unfortunately, this is, as usual with most problems, right? The rich will adapt. The poor are the one who truly suffer, which, of course, doesn't make this any easier, right, to tackle, because frankly, in many ways, the rich are the ones who have the most power when it comes to defining policy. And once again, that's what makes climate change yet again so a difficult problem. Right? It is us here in the rich world today who are causing most of the problem, while it's the poor future generations somewhere else who are going to suffer the most.
Well, I generally agree with you, but, you know, it also occurs to me that the wealthy, and that includes many of us here in the developed world, have become totally dependent on a big system that is fragile. Isn't it possible with a big storm or a climate breakdown, we could be helpless and confused when the grid goes down, our iPhones don't work, the electricity goes off, but a subsistence farmer in a remote mountain village might not even notice?
Sure, right? So I'm not saying that the rich will not be affected by climate change. Of course not, right? Just because you have the money to buy a second air conditioner doesn't mean that it doesn't cost you money. Of course, right? We will all be experiencing the consequence. But, I mean, there too, right, up to a point. I mean, this is not pushing it to extremes, right? But when you see that Hurricane Sandy is about to hit New York and you have a private jet waiting for you in another house somewhere else, well, you are not going to be as affected by Sandy as the person in a third-floor, one-bedroom walk-up who has nowhere else to go. And, by the way, that person, right, still lives in New York. So that person isn't necessarily truly poor here, just relatively poor to the guy who jets off with his private jet and brings himself to safety. But still, right, of course, it is, in fact, a problem that affects all of us. And in many ways, in monetary terms, of course, the rich are going to be hit more because, by definition, they have more assets, more capital, more money at stake here.
So you offer some steps to deal with the climate crisis, and it starts with the unlikely one of that we should scream. What are you talking about?
Well, a three-point plan, essentially, if you will, how you can have an impact. And step one is scream, in fact. And yes, it is scream for the right policies. Right now, in some sense, it goes back to recycling well or voting well, right? It's scream well, right? Scream for the right kind of policies. But that's sort of the point, right? This is a crisis. This is not a topic that we can push off onto future generations or not deal with in the proper way now, and frankly, in many ways, well, you can only scream for the right policies at this point. Now, that's not to say, right, that in fact is the only possible thing you could be doing, right? Screaming, in many ways, is the short here for, well, screaming for the policies, putting the kinds of policies in place that will, in fact, make a difference here.
And every time, Gernot, there's a big storm like Hurricane Katrina or Sandy in New England, politicians promise we'll rebuild things just the way they were. Insurance companies are ready to fund people to build their houses right where they were along the coast. Why is that so dumb, and what could we do better?
Well, the problem in many ways is, right, so we're rebuilding in the flood zones, in the kinds of areas that are going to be hit more or worse in the not-too-distant future. We're already experiencing this, of course, right? New York City was already hit by 200-year storms within 2 years, right? And yes, in many instances, we basically go back, rebuild, and even subsidize, essentially moving houses or building houses, building infrastructure in areas where they clearly ought not to be built. That is misguided policy if there ever was one.
All right, so your major solution is to put a price on carbon, and I wonder how that formula works when right now in the real world we're subsidizing fossil fuels instead of taxing them.
Yes, right. So the frustrating bit is, right, you're not even getting the sign right at this point. When you look at the $500 billion worth of fossil fuel subsidies and average that out, the average ton of CO2 we are currently emitting is subsidized to the tune of $15. So it's not so much a debate of what the right price is. We know that the price has to be positive. That's not a secret. We know it has to be at least $40 per ton of CO2 when you look at the U.S. government's calculations of what each ton of CO2 emitted today causes in terms of damages over its lifetime in the atmosphere. Meanwhile, we are going in the opposite direction.
Our guest on Radio EcoShock is Gernot Wagner, author of Climate Shock. Why not talk to us about the comparison between divesting from tobacco and divesting from fossil fuels?
That's an interesting analogy, right? So what you can actually do, point one was scream, point two we have cope, point three, not a surprise when you look at two economists writing a book, is profit. Now, of course, it's not profiting from climate change. It's profiting from the kinds of policies and the kinds of changes that ought to be put in place in order to avoid the problem in the first place. right? Or in other words, it's looking at something like solar energy decreasing by 80% in the last 5 years, the cost of solar energy decreasing by 80% in only 5 years, and looking at what that means. Well, how can you profit from that, right? Now, when you look at the analogy to tobacco and essentially the regulatory risk, if you will, to investors not recognizing that there is a problem, that analogy is pretty strong. In other words, it's not a question of if we do the right thing eventually. It's a question of when we're actually getting around to pricing carbon properly. Well, for tobacco, it's pretty much the same thing, right? There's no chance that, let's say, New York is going to sort of stop banning cigarettes in certain areas. If anything, those bans are only going to get tighter, right? They're going to be more ambitious. Well, in other words, the risk, the regulatory risk, only points in one direction. Well, same for CO2, same for greenhouse gas. So in other words, as an investor, as a business, as anyone looking at this problem sensibly, you can only look at things pointing in one direction. And there, the question is, if we as policymakers, the public, are going to make the right decisions on time, right? Not if, when.
Now, if climate policy continues to fail, I wonder if we'll see a bubble in valuations for startups in geoengineering, and are you in favor of geoengineering?
To answer your second question, no, I'm not in favor of saying let's look at something like geoengineering as an alternative in any way, shape, or form. What I am in favor of, what I think we ought to be doing, is look at geoengineering risk mitigation as a topic of potential research analysis that clearly ought to be taken seriously. And frankly, clearly ought to be taken seriously for one important reason. So this is when we as economists look at geoengineering. It looks like it has the exact opposite properties as the climate problem in the first place. In other words, right, why are we in this mess to begin with? Well, because it takes coordinated action by lots and lots of people, or at least governments, to make a difference here. And that action is costly. Well, it's not a free lunch, right? It might be cheap. It's a lot cheaper to do something about climate change than not to, but still, it's not a free lunch either. Well, when you look at geoengineering, in particular solar radiation management term, right, shooting sulfates into the stratosphere to create this artificial sun shield to cool the planet. Well, first of all, no, that's not a solution. It is not a replacement for decreasing CO2 emissions. It can't be. But it does have one important property. It is really, really cheap to do. We are talking millions of dollars, maybe tens of millions of dollars, as opposed to billions of dollars globally in order to have a quite significant impact. So in other words, you're looking at the exact opposite properties of climate change. And there too, you are not looking at if we are going to see action like that at some point. In many ways, it's a question of when, precisely because it is so cheap.
Now, thinking of the many members of Congress who deny that humans are causing climate change or that it's important if we are, I wonder if they get elected just because the public really doesn't want to give up all the benefits of fossil fuels. I'm not sure that I do. I like to drive around, you know, to get somewhere as opposed to being stuck within the radius that I can walk. That's a tough, tough problem to solve for a democracy.
It is. Now, of course, what we do see already is significant action, even if you're in the U.S., right? Even in the U.S. where you, like you said, right, many, many members of Congress deny that the problem even exists. Well, the majority no longer does, and especially the majority of the public recognizes that it is a problem and that we have to act. And yes, right, it is not an easy one to tackle because it affects so much of what our civilization is built on.
And you talk about the great unknowns of climate change as risks to be tamed, and inevitably we interviewers always fall into the trap and we say, well, what are the unknowns? And I know we don't know, but climate scientists have been able to predict some of the worst outcomes, and you've written about some of those scenarios in your book. What sorts of things are you talking about? Can you give us some clues?
Well, let me put it in sort of Don Rumsfeld terms, right? Our U.S. Secretary of Defense, former Secretary of Defense, is famous victim around invading Iraq, right? There are known knowns. There are known unknowns, right? Stuff that we know about, we just can't quantify, right? We don't know when it's going to hit. And then there are the big unknown unknowns. Now, to answer your question, right? No, I can't tell you what the unknown unknowns are. We simply don't know, right? That's, of course, the point. Now, for the known unknowns, we do, in fact, have pretty good indications, at least a sign of where these are going to go. And unfortunately, right, that's the kind of stuff that puts the shock into climate shock, because the sign of the vast, vast majority, if not all, of these known unknowns points in one and only one direction. In other words, the problem is much, much worse than we currently know to be the case.
Well, maybe you've just answered my next question, because I doubt that humans will act until irreversible climate change has already taken hold. Some say we're already there. Laying aside your role in the Environmental Defense Fund, where do you personally fit on the scale of doom to optimism?
Well, I'm certainly on the optimistic side when it comes to us now finally recognizing that this is such a significant problem and beginning to take the right actions. Are we on a path to solving climate change as we speak? Well, no, clearly not yet. Frankly, like solving is a funny term here anyways, right? Because like you said, there are already many, many consequences of climate change that we feel today already. Clearly, it's a matter of mitigating the risk here, decreasing the risk, minimizing the risk, if you will. Solving the problem is out. That said, right, am I optimistic that we are actually going to take the right actions? Yes, absolutely. Mainly because when you look at the actual forces now on the ground and when you look at the things happening at the policy level, whether it's here in the U.S., in states like California, even in Washington, right? The Obama administration, just this past August, put in place the Clean Power Plan. For the first time, we now have limits, we're going to have limits, on CO2 emissions from coal-fired power plants, both newly built power plants and existing ones. That's an amazing step in the right direction, and it is exactly these kinds of actions that we are seeing more and more of.
Is there anything I've missed now or a parting message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
This is, in fact, a solvable problem, right? Climate change is difficult. It's extremely difficult to tackle. In many ways, it's the perfect problem. But when you look at what's happening in state capitals like Sacramento here in the U.S., or in capitals like Beijing, right? China right now is experimenting with 7 regional cap and trade systems. So China is putting some of the right policies in place. Here in the U.S., we are looking at policy after policy pointing in the right direction, right? They don't yet add up to enough, but the momentum is clearly there. So yes, I am in fact optimistic that we can tackle this problem and frankly do it in our lifetimes.
We've been talking with Gernot Wagner. He's the lead senior economist at Environmental Defense Fund, along with Harvard economist Martin Weitzman. He's published the controversial book Climate Shock, The Economic Consequences of a Hotter Planet. And I've been waiting to hear about those for a long time, so I'm glad we had this chance to talk. You can find out more at climateshock.org and get links to YouTube videos with Gernot in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thanks so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.